I did work in the Attend Hospital, by the way. So I am a clinician, and I'm not an ethicist. And so this study really is a descriptive, qualitative, and I think you're going to enjoy it. So I don't have any conflict of interest. You know, over the last, I guess the whole humanitarian medicine has been around for maybe in a way that we know it, maybe 40 or 50 years. And then over the last maybe 10 to 15 years, because of the situation that happened and because of the media and the CNN effect and all of those things, so we know more about it, you know, the Southeast Asia tsunami, earthquake in Haiti, and obviously a lot of people who never really thought in the past as a clinician they're going to end up actually working in some, you know, different terrain and field, they ended up going to this situation. So the whole ethics and those kind of things that they have faced, as you mentioned, it's more pronounced now. And just the number, I mean, we have a lot of people actually working in the field of humanitarian aid. Now, I mean, you said it like, I guess, the disaster relief and humanitarian aid. I don't really know the difference, I have to be honest with you. I consider, I guess, both of them kind of the same, because in my mind, a humanitarian is that if someone doesn't have a capacity to respond to the needs that they have at the same time, so we really have to help them. Either is it a disaster, is a man-made disaster, is it a natural disaster. And so the number of the people are a lot. I mean, when I started working in this field was in mid-90s, and I think we had around 400 or 500 of international NGOs. And then right now we have probably 4,000 of NGOs in the Northern Hemisphere. And it's a good thing and a bad thing. And a number of people work in this field. So obviously has changed, the significant changes we have seen over the last 10 to 15 years. There's not a lot of data in terms of ethical challenges, some qualitative studies, and so I'm hopeful that we can contribute to that body of knowledge. So what we did was we basically did an interview with 44 of humanitarian workers. Now, these are a little bit different, and I think it's a good transition in a way that I really wanted to capture people who actually spent more than 3 years in the field. So they were kind of, let's just say, core humanitarian. You know, I don't know if there's something came out of that, but you know, generally someone who has committed. And so they have maybe different coping strategies, so they can elaborate on that. So that was the idea. And it was a part of a larger study, this ethic component of it. And we wanted to really know why people, what are the motivations that they have, what are the overall experience that they have, where they think the whole humanitarian medicine is going to go, the relief, humanitarian space, access, and all of those issues. And a part of it was their ethical experience and what suggestion they have. So this is kind of a part of that bigger study. Now, I didn't really use, obviously, a random sampling, and I really had connections, and so snowballing, I start getting in touch with them through the email, and then they connected me to other folks. And I really asked them, you know, give me someone who you think is going to be, in terms of thought process, in line with you, but also someone that you know that is completely different. So we're going to get to the different population. And then I really wanted to have a representative sample. So the criteria sampling really was, in a way, to include men, because, you know, the connection mostly was to women, as well as folks who are in different continents, originally from different continents. So that's a methodology, method section. So inclusion criteria, minimum of 3 years. It's a medical humanitarian NGO. There is a bias here, obviously, in exclusion. I guess we're going to get to that. They really had to have some form of working in a headquarter or coordination level, so they can bring that perspective as well. How the decisions are made and why those decisions are made. Normally, you don't get it when you're directly working in the field. And I really wanted to include only people who work for NGOs. And they could work for NGOs and UN agencies or governmental agencies, but not exclusively people who work for the government agencies. And that's the bias again. So then we did a lot of coding. You know, two basically coders independently went over the codings. And then we came together and discussed. It probably took us 12 months, multiple levels of discussion, input from the people who are expert in the field. And study is started in 2008, and today we have some results that I can present to you guys. So it was my introduction as well to the qualitative studies. All right, so let's go to... So participants from were from the major NGOs. Some of them are up there, MSF, ICRC, IRC, ARC, and as you can see, also the UN agencies. So I don't know if you can see, generally majority of them were male, oh, I'm sorry, female, and that's the age group that you can see, less than 30, around 2%, so most of them were young, let's just say that. And those are the areas that they were originated. I mean, we couldn't really get a good number of people who were from Africa or Asia, but most of them ended up being from the northern, from Europe and Northern America. I'm reading because if you can't see it, if you see it, I don't have to read it really. And so that, let's just talk about the number of the years in the humanitarian field. On average, it was around 8 years, and you know, the majority of them really spent a significant amount of time, more than 6 years in the field. Now, they work in both headquarters at the field level, and average number of the mission, as you can see, 6 to 9 seems to be. An area of a humanitarian experience mostly was in Africa, northern, and again, equally in western, eastern, northern Africa, and then in Asia is the next one. And the current position, majority of them at this moment, they had a headquarter level position, and they had also some of them, significant number of them, they were both in the field and headquarters. These are the areas that have worked. I mean, just many places, and the type of the position that they have, from the field physician up to the president of organization or NGOs. All right. So in general, these are the issues that came up. Then I'm going to go ahead and present some of the codes, and I give you time just to read it. And again, I'm not an ethicist. This is just descriptive, and we can discuss it. So the significant and important ethical dilemmas were the unintended impacts of the program on local community. People had issues with that. The fact that they believe majority, these are the core, they spend so much time, they still believe that they don't really provide adequate health care to the level that they thought it is practical and reasonable. So they are not idealistic at this moment in their career. And closing the programs prematurely, leaving people without any support was significant ethical dilemma for them. Turning away patients because they didn't have enough resources, I guess you mentioned that. And compromising quality for access, just being there and not being able to provide something that as a practitioner they were okay with it, but they really have to be there. And that really comes from the NGOs, again, you know, the whole socio-political context of the humanitarian intervention. Providing double standards of medical care or parallel work, this is, you know, the between NGOs or with the local, basically, partners. Lack of planning for any form of sustainability, and the broader foreign aid and socio-political, because the donor is going to really tell you, in majority of the cases, decide what you're supposed to do and where you're supposed to go, and basically, you know, not being consistent with the local culture and custom in terms of the way that you behave as an expatriate. So some of the codes. I can give you time to read. I don't have to really read through it, but maybe they're interesting, so I really want to flip through it. I put it out there. So this is important, and a very interesting case study in Angola. They provide an HIV program testing and push for testing, let's test everybody. And then they test someone, it was positive, and they really couldn't get a hold of the person. So the person disappeared. And they really didn't even have any kind of a system to provide any services to find that case. And the question was for this person, what is it that we are doing? Why we are testing anyway? And this is very important issues in a security context. And, you know, when there's a security issue, all of the expatriates are evacuated. And the local staff here are practitioners that they bring from, like, a capital of the country or other areas. They are local to the country, but not necessarily local to the context that the humanitarian issue happens, because the majority of cases you don't have enough, you know, health professionals. And so they leave them, you know, there. They don't take them with them. And that was a significant issue, is that why there is this double standard. And a larger concern was basically helping the bad government and basically fueling the conflict by providing a service, medical services to a group, an area. The negative influence of donors and funds and diversion of resources by locals, medical services to a group. An area, although it's not just necessarily Haiti, the fact that there is a hierarchy, social hierarchy at the local level. So here, you don't supposedly allocate the resources based on the worthiness of a community member. I mean, there is a clinical justice based on need or urgency and efficacy. You know, supposedly, if the president of the United States show up in a clinic, you're going to apply those basic ethical approaches. Now, here, because there are a lot of buffer system, you don't really face that, because people can go to different hospital, they can get a different doctor. But in a scenario, people who have power in the social hierarchy, they can get what they want, and there's nothing that you can do about it. And that was significant ethical issues that they have. So that's the influence by the local. But also where to go, what part of the community you can actually provide a service, yes or no. And general lack of, I guess we're talking about the professionalism and the way that you behave concerning the community values. This is another interesting quote that I guess probably the prominent example was in Rwanda, 1994. This is an example of the MSF that was MSF was providing services in the camp, and they thought that all of the medical services really is going to helping more the fighters. So basically fuels the actually active conflict. So they basically pulled out, despite the fact that they knew that maybe that 10 to 15%, you know, the population that not the fighters, they would get care, they're not going to get care. It's kind of a similar example. Did I go front or? So we're talking about the donors and basically what they want and what's the priority. An example that I personally remember was that before the Iraq War, Department of State in the United States asked 15 major NGOs in the U.S. to go to D.C. and provided $50 million for relief work after the war. And they said, but we want you to really go to the Kurdistan part of Iraq, because those are allies. So you go and do a need assessment, and you take the money, and you provide the medical services for those folks, but not the Sunnis or Shias in the south. And out of 15 NGOs, 14 of them, they stayed on the table. And the humanitarian charter says the humanitarian action should be based on the need and need only, no any other influences. But that's not the reality that happens. So they have those kind of ethical situation as well. Now, I mean, I know a close friend of mine from a very reputable NGO here in the U.S., they ended up going to Kurdistan, they provided services. But the broader philosophical approaches, obviously, was significant issues. So interesting quote again, you know, again, so U.S. kind of a policy. I believe this is Angola. I mean, I removed it, but it doesn't matter. I mean, it is Angola. Okay? I give you a minute to read it. Is this recorded or not? No, I'm kidding. I don't care. Another one. So this is really also treating a patient. The fact that most clinicians at the level of the field, that's the issue that they have. So if I can fix the measles case, then it's going to come back again. You know, 2 weeks from now, it's going to be a different type of infection. I'm not going to be here. They're going to die. And if I really, 5 minutes, okay, not a lot. And how far I go to provide that services, and where is the end? And it's difficult because you're applying your expectation and experience that you have from a good resource setting, and it's very difficult to really make that decision that how far are you going to go? Are you going to get them to really the maximum that you think is reasonable? And who am I to define what is reasonable or practical? Well, again, I give you time to read that. And I guess you remember there was issues of abuses or domestic sexual violence against refugees or people or beneficiaries that we were supposed to help. And in 2004-2005, and we had new policy in place, but so again, this is from 2008. I guess these are the issues that are still facing. That has not been implemented at least. So and then we asked them, how was this experience for you after so many years in the field? And one of them said, I really don't know how to answer that question. Okay, and so I'm listening to this, you know, recorded. And the pause is for like 3 minutes, and he says, I just can't answer that question. And then, you know, for some were positive, some were more pessimistic, and this is an example. So what are the contributing factor? You know, again, so there are some limited data, so I use what I think it is, so it's hypothesizing, as well as some of the data. Certainly we don't have adequate ethical preparation. I don't even think that we have in medical school, by the way. Here, but generally, definitely not for humanitarian medicine. And the complexity of the context, because there are so many factors sometimes in an acute disaster. An acute disaster, you know, sometimes it feels like it's 2 or 3 months, but in many cases, it's like 10 to 15 years, continue to be what we call chronic emergencies. The mortality and morbidity rates are constantly high, above the threshold. So it's acute, but it's for a long period of time. And the complexity really has all of this, the overall socio-political context. I don't know if we have time. Certainly, there are differences ideologically and socio-cultural. I think you discussed that, you know, what I consider is norm in this society and maybe the community value is completely different from what my understanding is that the right thing to do, and there is a conflict there. And we don't have really any form of framework to address that. And an issue of the differences between the principle of clinical and social justice is important because, you know, we are applying a clinical medicine in a huge social political context. There's so many factors, social factors into it. It's not really myself and my patient in the room, end of the story, and some the medicine to give to them. And there are significant issues with really long-term stress and burnout. People are burned out. You know, these folks stayed, but certainly there are you know, the bottom of the pyramid probably is 20 times more, and then at the end, just going to be a small number of them. I guess to say, one issue is that how we can transform this philosophical and experience to some form of a practical guideline to help the practitioner to actually make a better decision. I don't know. Some people propose something. There are some resources. But I think we have to work on it, as you mentioned. We really don't know a lot, but there are rooms to go beyond that. So some of the resources, you know, if you look at the Sphere Project, which is probably one of the best handbooks you can get, 1 minute. But they really tell you also, you have to have guidelines, but they don't tell you, you know, how to do it, and where is that guideline? And some folks from Canada, again, you know, they are doing a good work in terms of coming up with some kind of strategies to help the clinician right at the level of the local with the patient to make the better decision, to have input from the community, and to explore the values from the community or individual values and put something together to address the ethical issues at the patient levels. So I think the guidelines are important. What I think, I have two slides, please. So I think the important is the character building, both at the organizational level, because this NGO is going to dictate to some level what you're going to do at the end when you're exposed to the ethical situation, but also at the individual level, I think during the education. Definitely we have to be reflective. We have to really understand the different communities and values and incorporate those. You discussed about, you know, briefing and debriefing and providing opportunities for people to receive ethical counsel while they are in the field, as well as when they come back here in a systematic way, incorporate what they bring and try to create some form of a resource, maybe not a handbook, but some form of resource. And I'm not going to get to the broader social political issues, because we believe that the humanitarian space has been so shrinking just because of having the military humanitarianism and all of the things that we are facing.